skyline was silhouetted against the stars. The next day, Saturday, was nerve-wracking. We were alone in the state guest house except for a cooking staff who didn't speak a word of English, but who I suspected understood English just fine. At one point I mused to Neil that at least we'd gotten a great Korean dinner free of charge. He shrugged and said that to pay for the dinner the North Koreans had hosted, he had in fact handed over a great deal of American currency out of the bag of cash he was carrying around. At some point during the morning, the physician who had accompanied us was summoned to examine Bay and Miller. He returned a few hours later and reported they were both in good physical condition. The North Koreans had given him strict orders only to tell the prisoners that he was checking on their health and welfare, and not to mention there was an American delegation in the country, or that there was a possibility they could be freed. We took it as a good sign that he had been allowed to see them at all, although I felt as though we were trying to read tea leaves. At around 11 a.m., a mid-level staff officer from the Ministry of State Security arrived with a message from the DPRK government. He announced that the great leader Kim Jong-un had effectively demoted me, as the government no longer considered me a presidential envoy. The citizens of Pyongyang were aware, he continued, that my purpose was not to work toward peace between our two nations, but merely to free the two criminals. Accordingly, they could no longer guarantee my safety and security in the city of Pyongyang, nor the safety and security of my delegation, since its citizens were agitated. He left the guest house without further comment. As Neil noted in our debrief, waiting around isn't my strong suit, but because we were under control of the North Koreans, we weren't free to just hail a cab and tour Pyongyang. So we sat, paced, and shot the breeze, recognizing, of course, that we were undoubtedly being surveilled. The cooking staff prepared lunch, which we ate more to kill time than out of hunger. Periodically, two or three of us would take short walks in the park surrounding the guest house. If we went near the river, a couple of stone-faced minders would appear, seemingly out of nowhere, staying just within hearing range. They didn't object to our taking pictures of one another with the Daedong River as backdrop. At about 3:30 that afternoon, the staff officer returned. With no explanation, he told us to gather our luggage and check out. We had all traveled light and were already packed, so after more cash changed hands, we quickly piled into a small convoy and were driven downtown to the Koryo, a first-line hotel appointed in traditional North Korean style. We were ushered up to a conference room on the second floor and shown to seats at a large oval table. Five North Koreans, who we learned were prosecutors, sat across from us, four of them in suits and one in uniform. They barely acknowledged our arrival. Behind them, Kenneth Bay and Matthew Miller stood in their prison garb, each flanked by two guards. At the far end of the room was a smaller table with one empty chair. I suspected that whoever sat in judgment would have a bias. No one said a word, and the silence reminded me, oddly enough, of a church just before the service starts. This was the first time I laid eyes on the two American citizens. Miller looked tired and gaunt, while Bay, who had been in hard labor confinement for 2 years, appeared rested, even robust. They were both standing unsupported, which was a good sign, and comported with our doctor's report, but were impassive and didn't acknowledge our entrance. I wondered whether they understood that we were there for them, or if they thought this was a North Korean trick or trap to see if they would react inappropriately. We sat, still and silent, for 15 or 20 minutes, although at the time it seemed a lot longer. Finally, the door opened, and the first General Kim, the political four-star who'd met us at the airport, strode into the room. The prosecutors rose. We rose. General Kim sat. We sat. General Kim took a moment to get settled, and then looked up and nodded to the prosecutors. One of them stood and began reading a lengthy proclamation recounting the crimes of Miller and Bay against the peace-loving people of the DPRK. He paused after each section to allow a translator to render the proclamation in tortured English. Then he extolled the benevolence of Kim Jong-un and said that as a gesture of kindness, the great leader forgave the crimes and freed the criminals to my custody. General Kim stood. We all stood. Through the translator, he told me, I hope the next time we talk, it will be about something other than your criminals. He crossed the room and left, followed by the prosecutors, guards, and every other DPRK official. Our physician and a few members of the protective detail took Miller and Bay into a nearby room to help them change clothes and began to acclimatize them to the reality that they were free and about to head home. The rest of my detail hustled me out and downstairs to the limo, where I sat and waited for about 10 tense minutes, wondering if this could still go wrong. When Bay and Miller emerged from the hotel, I relaxed for the first time in days. When everyone was accounted for, the mini-convoy started toward the airport, wending its way through the city streets. This was my only real opportunity to see the streets of Pyongyang. Even during daytime on a Saturday, there weren't many cars or people out. The streets had no stoplights, but at the center of several intersections, women dressed in immaculate white tunics with white gloves stood on small raised platforms. They faced us with their arms held out to each side, keeping non-existent cars from crossing in front of us. I wondered if it was all a show for my benefit, or if they stood and gesticulated on those platforms every day. We drove past the famous square where the DPRK army had, over the years, marched in their characteristic unnerving goose step for stage-produced parades in salute of three generations of Kim family leaders. The square seemed much smaller in person than in film footage of those events. I watched out the window as the peace-loving people of Pyongyang swept the streets and sidewalks and walked slowly, almost zombie-like, to I don't know where. The experience was even more surreal than I'd imagined. I had expected the drab clothes and their lack of possessions, and certainly no cell phones, but I was also struck by how no one seemed to show any emotion. They didn't stop to greet one another, didn't nod hello, and no one was conversing or laughing. As we rode, the staff officer from the Ministry of State Security spoke through the translator with the British accent, whom I was almost glad to see and hear again. The atmosphere and tone were more temperate. Even the translations were less formal, more conversational. The MSS officer asked what I thought of the DPRK, and I told him I'd had little opportunity to see much of it. He asked me whether I would be willing to come back. I responded that if I were invited, I would be pleased to return. During the rest of the drive, he talked about what a shame it was that the Korean people had been divided for so long, tragically separating so many families. He noted that even their language was growing apart as the dialect of the South changed with the Western influences there. As we approached the airport, he remarked, and I'll never forget this, I have been to Seoul. I have seen what's there. I would hope that someday we can unify. I suspect this conversation was just as staged as every interaction I'd had since we'd arrived, but I found his comments, demeanor, and tone compelling. I think the intent was to conclude my visit on a more positive note. Finally, Sunan Airport came into view. No aircraft with United States of America emblazoned across it ever looked more beautiful. I boarded first and moved to the back of the plane as our two newly freed citizens took seats up front. We'd made the conscious choice to minimize my involvement in securing their freedom to avoid the appearance that this had been a U.S. intelligence operation, and so I left the direct interactions with them to others in the party. We flew from North Korea to Guam, Hawaii, and then on to Joint Base Lewis McChord in Washington State. As Miller and Bay debarked, I walked to the cockpit to watch their emotional reunions with their families. Leaving North Korea with them had given me a sense of relief. Witnessing their embraces and seeing them express the emotion they had been forbidden from showing during their release ceremony in Pyongyang was something much more powerful. When the cameras stopped rolling, a truck towed our plane away to refuel for our last leg to Andrews Air Force Base. As I watched Bay and Miller walk away with their families, I thought how the view from that cockpit sure beat the view from under the bus. Shortly after we took off, President Obama called to thank and congratulate the entire team on our success, and I passed along his message. Everyone cheered, and we shared some high fives and fist bumps. We landed at Andrews sometime after 2 a.m. Monday, and when I finally arrived home about 45 minutes later, I was tired but still keyed up enough to stay awake into the wee hours to share my adventure with Sue. Typically, on Monday, I conduct an expanded staff meeting for senior ODNI leaders. When I walked into the conference room that morning, it was packed. The group stood and applauded, beaming at me with pride, which took me off guard. When we all sat down, I tried to lighten things up by asking, "Anyone go anywhere special this weekend?" I gave them a debrief of the events of the past week, which served as a dry run for a similar account I gave the president a week later when he returned from China. The president was in his habitual spot when I entered the Oval Office, in the chair just in front of and on the right side of the fireplace. Susan and the National Security team were there, and White House photographer Pete Souza was on the periphery, snapping pictures, as was his official practice. I took my then-customary place on the couch to the president's right and spent the next 15 minutes describing the trip. When I mentioned the New York Times theory of why he'd picked me for the mission, he laughed and agreed with their take. At some point, Pete stopped taking photos and just listened. As I wrapped up, the president said he was grateful to everyone involved and asked me again to pass that on to the team, and not only those who had accompanied me, but to everyone who had supported the trip. Even though we'd had a few rough spots over the past year, I knew that President Obama never took for granted all the invisible people who work behind the scenes to make sure missions succeed and intelligence makes it to military commanders in the field and to the Oval Office each morning. Looking back, perhaps the most impressive aspect of the North Korean mission was that in our post-WikiLeaks world, no one involved had leaked anything to the media. Our success demonstrated that not only is the IC populated by people who can keep secrets, but our profession is filled with creative and dedicated individuals across the globe who can operate in unfamiliar and dangerous places and take on tasks they could never really have trained for. I couldn't have been prouder. Chapter 10. Unpredictable Instability. While my North Korea trip officially ended November 9th, one interaction I'd had in the Hermit Kingdom took on added significance 2 weeks later. On November 24th, a hacker group calling itself the Guardians of Peace published a tranche of personal emails and embarrassing information about the executives at Sony Pictures. Over the next couple of days, the hackers continued to post emails and documents and even yet-to-be-released Sony movies, and they then tried to sabotage Sony Pictures' IT operating systems. They threatened to do more damage if Sony didn't cancel the release of The Interview, billed as a comedy about a reporter and a producer, played by James Franco and Seth Rogen, who, before going to North Korea to interview Kim Jong-un, are recruited by the CIA to assassinate him. By the way, not something the CIA does in real life anymore, and hasn't for decades. The IC got involved with the cyber breach, used forensics I can't write about, and at a classified level demonstrated, without a shadow of a doubt in my mind and those of our top cyber specialists, that the Sony hacks had originated in North Korea, and that to do what they'd accomplished, the North Koreans had been on Sony Pictures systems for weeks, even months. It was an eerie moment for me as I thought back to the dinner I'd had on Friday night, November 7th, the wonderful food and the hostile company. General Kim, whom I'd assumed was my host until I learned we'd actually paid for the meal, was the director of the RGB, the agency that ran foreign intelligence collection, special operations, and cyber operations. So it was he who ultimately would have ordered the cyber assault against Sony. Reading the intelligence assessments, I realized the hacking operation had been well underway as we were enjoying each other's company that night. I would say he kept a good poker face, except that I've never played poker with anyone who just yelled at me for hours on end. All of the vitriol he spewed over that dinner was genuine. The DPRK really does believe it's under siege from all directions. Its people are deadly serious about affronts to the supreme leader, whom they consider to be a deity, and there's no room for dissent, not when the favorite management technique of its leader is public executions. It's super effective. That's why the interview upset them so much. In Kim Jong-un's mind, allowing this film to be released would mean showing weakness, which might cost him his rule and his status as a deity, not to mention his life. In response, in June 2014, North Korea threatened action against the U.S. government. Sometime between then and November, the DPRK realized that the government doesn't control the American film industry, so it went after the distributor, first hacking and leaking damaging information, and then threatening terrorist attacks on any theater that screened the film. A few independent movie chains, like Alamo Drafthouse, wanted to call the North Korean government's bluff, but for larger theater chains, the 2012 shooting at an Aurora, Colorado movie theater was still too fresh and raw. So Sony Pictures canceled the theatrical release and instead, on December 24th, released the film for online rental and purchase, where it still turned a profit. I did my patriotic duty and paid to stream the film, which confirmed two things I already knew. One, Franco and Rogan have a lot of fun making silly movies together, and two, the North Koreans don't have a sense of humor. In January 2015, I spoke at the International Conference on Cybersecurity at Fordham University, the first government official to discuss North Korea as the perpetrator of the Sony Pictures hack. I was first only because Jim Comey and Mike Rogers were scheduled to speak on the subject later in the day. After telling them about my interactions with General Kim over dinner, I figured I should offer some insight from our IC cyber experts, since industry was under a constant barrage of cyber intrusions. First, I gave the conference the IC's perspective. Taken altogether, cyber poses an incredibly complex set of threats because criminals and hacktivist collectives like Anonymous are all thrown in together with aggressors like North Korea and Iran and with the Russians and Chinese, who could do real damage if they are so inclined. Each of those actors has different capabilities and different objectives when they engage in cyberspace, and all of them operate on the same internet. Back in the halcyon days of the Cold War, the world essentially had two large, mutually exclusive communications networks. One was dominated by the United States and our allies, and the other by the Soviets. We could therefore be reasonably sure that if we were listening to someone on the Soviet-dominated network, that person was not a U.S. citizen. Today, it's not so clean and easy. I also offered the conference four pieces of advice from our cyber experts. One, patch IT software obsessively. Most Chinese cyber intrusions are through well-known vulnerabilities that can be fixed with patches already available. Two, segment your data. A single breach shouldn't give attackers access to an entire network infrastructure and a motherload of proprietary data. Three, pay attention to the threat bulletins that DHS and FBI put out. And four, teach folks what spear phishing looks like. So many times the Chinese and others get access to our systems just by pretending to be someone else and then asking for access, and someone gives it to them. A few months later, I was surprised to find an online article with the headline, "What Law Firms Can Learn from James Clapper." Since most of the time Bob Litt and other attorneys on ODNI's staff are educating me, I succumbed to the clickbait and read the article. A guy named Daniel Lewis, who specializes in firm security, had picked up my 4 points and applied them to law firm cyber practices. If that resulted in a single firm protecting its systems better, I'm glad he shared it. Of course, my last piece of advice didn't concern protecting systems from hacking. Spear phishing doesn't require someone to have special coding skills to obtain unauthorized access or control of your computer or network. It's social engineering, tricking people, not systems. And everyone's vulnerable to it. About a year after my speech at Fordham, someone called the phone and internet service provider Sue and I used, claiming to be someone he wasn't, and our provider gave them access to Sue's email account. From there, they got into an account assigned to me that I'd never used, and leveraged that access to play some jokes. It was less of a security issue and more like griefing cyber vandalism. And by then, it had become something of a status symbol among the Washington Beltway elites to be cool enough to get hacked. I got to join John Brennan as one of the new initiates in that club. Later in 2015, our counterintelligence and security team determined that approximately 90% of all cyber intrusions start with phishing, because there are always unwitting victims who fall for the scheme. So when I was giving my four pieces of advice to industry, I was careful not to sound too pious. In January 2015, we hadn't had any massive government losses, at least not that we knew of, on the scale of what had happened to Sony, which was already costing them hundreds of millions of dollars. We did know, though, that the larger federal government wasn't following the advice my security folks had armed me with, and we were just as vulnerable as everyone else. A few weeks later, when I again presented the IC's annual report, I again opened with cyber. As I told Congress, attacks against us are increasing in frequency, scale, sophistication, and severity of impact. Although we must be prepared for a catastrophic large-scale strike, a so-called cyber Armageddon, the reality is that we've been living with a constant and expanding barrage of cyber attacks for some time. The first draft of my statement actually called for me to say that we didn't consider a cyber Armageddon to even be a real threat, but we decided that having me state that on camera would only be tempting fate, and if, for instance, Russia ever decided to attack our infrastructure, as they'd done on a limited scale to several of their neighbors, a clip of me giving assurances that cyber Armageddon isn't a real threat would be played on loop on whatever media infrastructure was left. So I merely focused on the ongoing cyber onslaught. Citing cyber first in my presentation didn't mean the terrorist threat had diminished. In fact, the cancer of Al-Qaeda had made further incursions into the Western world. On January 7, 2015, terrorists who claimed to represent Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula had walked into the Paris offices of Charlie Hebdo, a French satirical magazine that had pointedly lampooned the Prophet Muhammad. Calling out names of cartoonists and targeting them with gunfire, they killed 12 and wounded another 11. A massive manhunt and continued violence in Paris followed. On January 10th, 2 million people, including 40 world leaders, marched in defiance of the violence through the streets of Paris, along with another 1.5 to 2 million in other French cities. I appreciated the show of worldwide solidarity, but I had also seen the intelligence and media reports that Boko Haram had murdered 2,000 people in Nigeria between January 4th and 7th, and I wished those victims could also have such public attention. Terrorist violence was in fact accelerating around the entire world. I told Congress that while we only had statistics for the first 9 months of 2014, in that period some 13,000 terrorist attacks had resulted in 31,000 deaths, far more than the 12-month totals for 2013, and we already knew that 2015 was off to a horrific start. Many of the threats we laid out in our report were getting worse because of one major global trend that I called unpredictable instability. I explained that unpredictable instability was both the new normal and the driving force behind many of the world's woes. The year 2014 saw the highest rate of political instability since 1992, most deaths as a result of state-sponsored mass killings since the early 1990s, and the highest number of refugees and internally displaced persons since World War II. Roughly half of the world's currently stable countries are at some risk of instability over the next 2 years. What made this instability unpredictable was that so many nations across the globe showed signs of it, and there was no way to predict what sort of event, even something as localized as a fruit seller's self-immolation, might trigger citizens to revolt, a military to seize power, or an aggressive neighbor to grab territory. My discussion of unpredictable instability made some headlines. What would have truly made national news was the conversations we'd had behind closed doors that, based on publicly available information and not on any particular intelligence, the United States had begun to show many of the same characteristics of instability we used to assess other nation-states. First among these was increasing inequality of income and wealth. The Center for American Progress had published a report in the fall of 2014 with some astounding statistics. As it wrote in an analysis of the 2007 to 2009 recession, 95% of all income gains since the start of the recovery have accrued to the top 1% of U.S. households. This was only part of a longer trend. From 1983 to 2010, the top fifth of U.S. families by net worth had increased their wealth by 120%, and the middle fifth by only 13%. The net worth of the bottom fifth had decreased in that period. Looking at the theoretical household at the perfect center of American earnings, 50% of American families earning more and 50% earning less, they wrote, "The median family saw its income fall by 8% between 2000 and 2012. At the same time, they noted that child care costs grew by 37% and health care costs by 85%. In fact, they added, investing in the basic pillars of middle-class security, child care, housing, and health care, as well as setting aside modest savings for retirement and college, cost an alarming $10,600 more in 2012 than it did in 2000. The United States also had an increasingly restive population of young people who couldn't find work, many of them with crushing college debt. Companies had laid off workers of all ages during the recession, and on recovery found that with automation and digital technology advances, they didn't need to hire people back once money started flowing again. Making the situation worse, unemployment was often geographically focused, with some small towns and even larger regions finding the manufacturing jobs that had supported their economies completely dried up. In many ways, there was a growing overlap of the urban versus rural divide and the have versus have not divide. Those segments of society increasingly looked at each other with resentment, and people who lived in the more rural, less educated areas of the country no longer felt represented in a government they perceived as dominated by liberal elites. The state of political discourse in the media and among politicians, meanwhile, had descended to a winner-take-all, scorched-earth mentality. It was a trend that had been developing for decades, but one that Republican strategist Karl Rove turned into a science for the 2000 election, the Tea Party into an art form for the 2010 election, and social media into an epidemic since then. Social networks had siloed people into echo chambers with those who shared similar viewpoints, amplifying their anger. All of this concerned many of us who had watched the Arab Spring lead to uprisings throughout the Middle East and North Africa. We didn't see the United States turning into the next Syria, but what these symptoms would eventually lead to was, again, unpredictable instability. Regardless, as always, our personal concerns remained private because our professional attention as intelligence officers was always turned outward to understanding the world and helping policymakers work to make it safer. March presented us with a great opportunity to advance global safety and security. At the end of the month, representatives from the permanent members of the UN Security Council the United States, the United Kingdom, Russia, France, and China, met in Lausanne, Switzerland, with representatives from Germany, the European Union, and Iran to discuss creating the framework for a deal to stop Iran's nuclear weapons program. Many people, including many politicians and recognizable media figures, misunderstood how narrow and limited this goal was. No deal we could achieve was going to be able to compel Iran to stop sponsoring terrorism, interfering with operations in Iraq and Syria, or menacing its neighbors, particularly Israel. As I said publicly, to me this all boiled down to the question of whether we would rather have a state sponsor of terrorism with a nuclear weapons capability, or a state sponsor of terrorism without a nuclear weapons capability. Between March 26th and April 2nd, Secretary of State John Kerry and his team became demanding consumers of intelligence. Their questions came in rapid-fire bursts, and we tasked the intelligence production cycle with responding to them quickly, sometimes within hours, all while meeting similar demands from the President and the National Security Council. It was a stressful 8 days, but at the end, the group of foreign ministers announced they had reached solutions on key parameters of a joint comprehensive plan of action, namely that Iran would give up nuclear materials that could be weaponized, and that it would allow international inspectors access to its nuclear power facilities at a level no other nation on Earth had ever permitted. In return, it would regain access to perhaps $100 billion of its assets that had been frozen by sanctions specific to its nuclear weapons program. The April 2nd agreement was just a framework for a future deal, a point stressed by Iranian Foreign Affairs Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, who announced, "No agreement has been reached, so we do not have any obligation yet." That was true, but we knew that the mere fact of arriving at a framework for an agreement validated the work the intelligence community had been doing for decades and the power of political and economic pressures we'd worked so hard to support. It also illustrated the value of persistent intelligence over time, often a long time. The announcement of the Iran nuclear deal framework was a terrific high note leading on to ODNI's 10th anniversary celebration. On Friday, April 24th, President Obama spoke at our headquarters, opening, as I mentioned earlier, by poking fun at my briefing proclivities and presenting me with a jar of paper clips he said I'd left strewn around the Oval Office. To further laughter and applause, he noted for the crowd, "Today is also special to him because it happens to be his 50th wedding anniversary to his wonderful wife, Sue. So we want to congratulate the two of them, and fear not, this is not all he's doing for their 50th wedding anniversary." Sue smiled in appreciation. The president used most of his speech to recognize the effort and impact the IC has had on national security, repeatedly telling the workforce, "You can take great pride in your service." He concluded with specific accomplishments he was grateful for. "I don't want you or folks across the intelligence community to ever forget the difference that you make every day. Because of you, we've had the intelligence to take out al-Qaeda leaders, including Osama bin Laden. Because of you, we've had the intelligence, quickly, that showed Syria had used chemical weapons, and then had the ability to monitor its removal. Because of you, we had the intelligence, despite Russia's obfuscations, to tell the world the truth about the downing of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over Ukraine. Because of you, we had the intelligence support that helped enable our recent nuclear framework with Iran. And you're going to be critical to our efforts to forge a comprehensive deal to prevent Iran from ever getting a nuclear weapon. So you help keep us safe, but you also help protect our freedoms by doing it the right way. And the American people and people around the world may never know the full extent of your success. There may be those outside who question or challenge what we do, and we welcome those questions and those challenges because that makes us better. It can be frustrating sometimes, but that's part of the function of our democracy. But I know what you do. We're more secure because of your service. We're more secure because of your patriotism and your professionalism. And I'm grateful for that. And the American people are grateful as well, to you and your families who sacrifice alongside you. Life has a strange way of keeping my ego in check whenever I'm starting to feel too puffed up about my role in community accomplishments. In April, one of those checks came in the form of a Fairfax County, Virginia jury duty summons. My assistant, Stephanie Sherline, called the county courthouse, got in touch with an actual person, a very sweet lady in the county clerk's office, and explained who I was, what I did, and that my security detail would have to accompany me into court. The lady considered for a moment and then replied that none of that sounded like a legitimate reason for getting out of jury duty. However, she did note that I was 74 years old, and that because many older people have a hard time sitting through the process, Fairfax County has an automatic exemption for anyone over the age of 70. I'd like to think Stephanie paused at least a moment before saying, "Yes, we'll take the geezer exemption." So, life keeps you humble. Sometimes it does so with humor, and sometimes with a jarring sobriety. On May 1st, Sue and I left for a weekend trip to Salem, Virginia, to visit our son Andy's family and watch our youngest grandson play in a soccer tournament. After the tournament, we went to a Class AA baseball game. As the game progressed, Sue became very quiet. I asked if she was feeling all right, and she answered that she was very tired. So we left. In the SUV, her conversational responses became less and less coherent. Fortunately, the lead security detail officer happened to be a paramedic and conducted an exam. He found the results were more than a little concerning. So our detail driver flipped on the lights and sirens, and we sped to the Salem Hospital, where Sue was admitted to the emergency room. I stood and watched as the ER doctor in Salem held a video teleconference with a neurologist in Houston. Between them, they couldn't figure out what was happening, but eventually concluded that she was exhibiting stroke-like symptoms, but wasn't suffering a stroke. I mentioned a previous episode she'd had 7 years earlier, in which she'd become quiet and lethargic for a few days, but explained that her current condition was worse by orders of magnitude. We kept watch as, over the next few hours, Sue fell into a comatose state. She spent the next 3 days in a coma in the Salem hospital, and I didn't leave that room. The security detail officers were saints, going far beyond their job descriptions to care for my family and to keep Stephanie O'Sullivan and the other IC leaders updated. I knew that when it came to running the community, Stephanie was every bit my equal, and then some. And my confidence in her enabled me to focus on Sue, holding her hand and talking to her and visiting with my kids and grandkids in the hospital room. After 3 days, we hired an ambulance to drive Sue from Salem to Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda. On the ride there, she awoke to a semi-conscious state, but was not coherent. At midnight, ODNI's lead for personal security met us at Walter Reed's emergency room and helped us settle there. Over the next week or so, Sue gradually returned, although it was 6 months or more before she felt like herself again. The doctors never really figured out what had gone wrong. A lot of thoughts passed through my head while I sat in a hospital room holding my wife's motionless hand in the middle of the night. During our 50 years of marriage, I'd spent all but a few focused on service to the nation. I thought of it as selfless, but of course when I'd returned to lead NEMA 14 years earlier, it had been over Sue's objections, and because I'd missed the psychic income, which was, in retrospect, a selfish reason. While I'd served our nation, she'd served our family, raising Jen and Andy, maintaining our house and finances, and living life mostly alone and independent. I really hadn't appreciated the toll those 5 decades had taken on her. And even without the guilt from recognizing those realities, I had to face the fact that I was 74 and Sue was 71. I suddenly became all too aware of mortality, hers, mine, and others. So that first night in the Salem hospital, I resolved that whatever Sue's outcome would be, I would resign as DNI and spend the rest of my time focused on her and our kids and grandkids. That plan didn't last long, not because the community wouldn't have been just fine without me, but because after Sue began to recover, I realized she might not want me quite so attentive to her every need around the clock. She didn't know I knew this, but with the security detail and with Andy and Jen, Sue had nicknamed me Huey, because I was always hovering like a helicopter beside her bed. It went unsaid, but I think she was greatly relieved when I went into the office for a few hours on Friday, May 8th. So I didn't resign, but I worked shorter hours for a few weeks, and I came to grips with the reality that I had just 20 months left before I handed off the reins to the next generation, and that whoever won the election in 2016, I would walk away on January 20th, 2017, with no regrets. I envisioned myself sort of tap dancing off stage, preferably to very little fanfare, as everyone focused on what was next for our community and nation. But there were a few things I wanted to do, successes and progress I wanted to make permanent in the time I had left on the job. I started to consider my legacy, not the grade historians might give me on my DNI term paper, but rather the state of the community I'd be leaving behind. I'd stepped into the DNI position honoring the mantra of intelligence integration, and the IC had made very real advances toward achieving that goal since 9/11, which we'd reinforced in the years I'd been DNI. That was one change I wanted to make permanent. With time to reflect, I saw that the second big change we needed to solidify was increased transparency. I'd been saying publicly for nearly 2 years that transparency was just something we had to achieve, however much it initially felt almost genetically antithetical to me. By May 2015, somewhat to my surprise, I realized that it no longer felt that way to talk publicly about our work. On May 20th, a transparency project we'd been working on for 4 years came to fruition when we released an initial collection of the books, papers, computer files, and documents the Special Operations Team had collected during the Abbottabad raid in 2011, which we had come to refer to as Bin Laden's Bookshelf. The day we published it, I flew to Tampa to address the annual Special Operations Forces Gala. That evening, I told those in attendance, "The materials you took in 2011 from Bin Laden's house have been invaluable in our continued fight against Al-Qaeda, and we've come to understand they're also important to history. I think it's interesting to see what works influenced him, but those who want to see him as a supervillain are going to be disappointed." There was no Sun Tzu, but about half of the 38 full-length English language books he had, and seems to have read closely, were conspiracy theory books about the Illuminati and Freemasons. I'm not making that up. To say there was public interest in Bin Laden's Bookshelf would be an understatement. We got as much web traffic in 2 days, 750,000 site visits and 2 million page views, as our website had received in all of 2013 and 2014 put together. For a while afterward, if someone ran a Google search for Bin Laden, DNI.gov was the number 2 search result, behind only Wikipedia. Over the rest of my time in office, we continued to update the bookshelf as we cleared documents for public release, and while there was always a group of conspiracy-minded people out there, including a few members of Congress, who believed that we were keeping the good stuff, we weren't holding back anything of legitimate public interest unless there were valid concerns with protecting intelligence sources and methods. Another group of like-minded people did figure out what we were holding back, and they continually submitted Freedom of Information Act requests for any pornography collected in Abbottabad. We declined those requests. Thanks to our Tumblr site, IC on the Record, and to Bin Laden's Bookshelf, our transparency initiatives were running smoothly. Stephanie O'Sullivan and our IC Deputies Committee were driving intelligence integration, pushing to shift control of the EyeSight initiative away from the information technology leaders to the intelligence mission leaders. As a young engineer, early in her career, she'd spent her free time working as the pit crew chief in an amateur auto racing circuit and had a knack for relating the IC mission to that hobby. In that spring of 2015, she told an audience of collection and analysis leaders that the new IT systems coming out through EyeSight were like a finely tuned race car built by the IT engineers. She challenged them to rethink business applications rather than just methods for sending emails faster. "If you keep doing the same old things with the brand new system, that's like saying you really like the new racing car we built for you, but it's too fast. And you're only comfortable driving it if we put on a 35 miles per hour governor. Don't do that. Take your game up a notch, or better yet, a whole bunch of notches at once. You have a chance to completely change how you do business." Given these successes, I naturally began to expect something to go wrong, fitting the pattern of my first 5 years as DNI. What I didn't expect was to uncover a massive foreign intelligence operation aimed at the people of the IC. As far back as March 2014, we knew that Chinese hackers were trying to penetrate the Office of Personnel Management, which recruits and manages the 2 million or so employees of the federal workforce, or to hack into the companies it had contracted with to perform security clearance investigations. OPM believed it had fended off every cyber assault, but in 2015 we found out that wasn't remotely true. While running new software designed to detect intrusions, OPM discovered that they were compromised, and then slowly uncovered just how bad the intrusion was. On June 4th, OPM announced that the names, birth dates, home addresses, and social security numbers of 4.2 million current and former federal employees had been stolen. As OPM was sending out notifications to those who were affected, it found another, much worse, intrusion. Someone had accessed and exfiltrated 19.7 million security clearance applications. Not only was the applicant information stolen, but the applications themselves revealed information about 1.8 million non-applicants referenced in the applications, mostly family members. Even worse, they got transcripts of interviews conducted by background investigators, along with the usernames and passwords that applicants had used to fill out forms online, and 5.6 million fingerprint files. We all but knew from the start that Chinese intelligence was responsible for the theft, and the counterintelligence implications were staggering, not just from what they had, but from what they didn't have. OPM didn't conduct security clearance investigations for all of the IC elements, and whoever had the wherewithal to penetrate its systems would certainly know which agencies and departments OPM conducted investigations for and which they didn't. They could therefore also start making assumptions about cover for cleared people whose files they didn't have. Congress fumed at me and anyone else who came to testify about the OPM hack. During a town hall, I noted for the ODNI staff, "I've spent some time up on the Hill talking about the breaches and cyber threats in general. I've heard a lot of outrage over the loss of information and over our apparent lack of response. On the Hill, outrage is now used as a verb. I can even conjugate it. I outrage, you outrage. He, she, they outrage." In closed briefings, Congress demanded I commit to a proportional cyber response against China, which was just ridiculous on a number of levels. First, any response was a policy decision, and I'd made it clear for the previous 5 years that I don't get involved in those. Second, reciprocity and collateral damage in cyberspace are very difficult to control. NSA and Cyber Command, both still under Admiral Mike Rogers' leadership, had tremendous capabilities, and we felt it was reasonable, but not certain, that if we did decide to attack someone, we would affect only the systems we specifically targeted, but no one else in the world could reasonably be that confident about their abilities, and the infrastructure for the Internet was largely independent of international boundaries. So if we attacked someone in cyberspace and they returned fire, Cyber Command and even DOD and the IC might have some level of protection and defense, but the New York Stock Exchange, or telecommunications in Eastern Europe, or a power grid in Central America might well be taken offline. No one could predict the unintended consequences and potential damage such an assault might cause. I was particularly attuned to these second and third order vulnerabilities because of a discussion at a principals committee meeting during President Obama's first term about retaliating for cyber intrusions into Wall Street. After several secretaries shared hawkish opinions, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, who by any measure should have been the most aggrieved person in the room, asked a simple question. Does anyone here know what would happen if there was a serious cyber attack on our financial institutions? Because I don't. That ended the discussion. In 2015, I was the Principals Committee member whose equities had been most injured and, like Geithner had been, was most opposed to an aggressive response. In fact, I was much less outraged by the Chinese intrusion than almost anyone else, a fact that caused a bit of a stir on June 25th when I publicly discussed the case. After I gave the closing keynote speech at the 2015 GEOINT Symposium, Jim Sciutto of CNN moderated the question and answer session that followed. When Jim began the discussion by asking me about the OPM cyber theft, I answered candidly, "You know, on one hand, please don't take this the wrong way, you have to kind of salute the Chinese for what they did. If we had the opportunity to do that, I don't think we'd hesitate for a minute." There was a brief pause before Jim gave me an out from being the first government official, without asking for anonymity, to blame China. He asked, "Just to be clear, are you identifying China as the perpetrator behind the OPM attack?" There was some nervous laughter in the crowd. I couched my answer just a little. "Well, I mean, that's the leading suspect." My security detail drove me from the D.C. Convention Center to the White House for back-to-back national security meetings, first with the president and then another without him. When I returned to the office, I learned that I'd caused a kerfuffle. Apparently, as I'd been naming China as the leading suspect, OPM Director Catherine Archuleta had been declining to attribute the attack in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee, a discrepancy Congress and the media picked up on. I was honestly surprised that my remarks had made the news, as no one at the White House had been upset about them, including the president. More to the point, I told my staff that we would have looked silly if everyone in Washington was anonymously saying that China did it, if everyone knew China did it. But I wouldn't go on the record acknowledging that fact. More to the point, and maybe this was me being naive as to what the news cycle cared about, I hadn't thought naming and shaming China would be the controversial part of my comments. To me, the important point, which wasn't quickly picked up on, was that I'd said China had hurt us dearly, but that it hadn't done anything outside the bounds of what nation-states do when conducting espionage. They'd exploited a vulnerability in a way not fundamentally different from how, at the age of 12, I had hacked the Philadelphia Police Department. The Philadelphia PD hadn't intended to let me listen in to their conversations in 1953, just as OPM hadn't intended to let China gain access to everyone's security clearance paperwork in 2015. This wasn't just an idle academic observation. In NSC meetings that summer, I got more involved with policy decisions than I typically would have, arguing that if we responded, we needed to treat what China had done as an act of cyber espionage, not cyber warfare. I warned that how we responded would set a precedent that might come back to haunt us if we ever took a similar opportunity to collect on someone else. In the end, we didn't do much beyond making the symbolic gestures that typically take place after one nation discovers it's been successfully spied on. For the affected security clearance holders, the fact that it was Chinese intelligence that had stolen their information was, truthfully, both good news and bad. The good news was that Chinese intelligence was not likely to sell their personal information on the black market, so the employees were less likely to become victims of identity theft than if cyber criminals had perpetrated this breach. The bad news was that elements of Chinese intelligence suddenly had a large body of information they could potentially exploit to compromise our employees professionally or to gain access to the agencies or companies for whom they worked. The theft did get intelligence leaders to consider what else cyber actors could do to and with our information. As I continued to proselytize the four commandments of cybersecurity, I explained three different ways that that information could be affected. First, and most obviously, cyber spies, criminals, and terrorist entities all try to steal our data, undermining confidentiality, so that we can't trust that any information is private. Second, when we're the target of denial-of-service operations, or someone breaks into our system and deletes data, we're prevented from accessing our own information, undermining availability. The hacker group Anonymous seemed to enjoy shutting down government websites by flooding them with automated web traffic. We put safety systems in place to counter this, including some that act like circuit breakers, so that if there's a sudden surge in traffic, the program takes the site offline. When we published Bin Laden's bookshelf, we had to warn our cybersecurity officers ahead of time to disable the circuit breakers, because we anticipated a sudden rise in traffic that would otherwise have indicated a denial-of-service attack. But there was a third potential way to exploit data we hadn't yet seen used. I had started warning public groups that in the future, cyber operations would attempt to manipulate information to compromise its integrity. In other words, an offensive cyber organization with the skills, technology, and persistence of the Chinese could change our data itself without doing anything as noticeable as exfiltrating it or blocking our access to it. I urged people to imagine the chaos that could have resulted if the Chinese had actually changed people's security clearance background investigation results. What if a hostile party altered the specs for the construction of an aircraft or spacecraft? How would making even subtle changes to data affect our defense industry, financial sector, or medical record keepers? Not only were our vulnerabilities growing, but in some ways our opportunities were shrinking. As a second or third order effect of Snowden's leaks, encryption technologies sold by commercial industry were proliferating, and even relatively low-tech terrorist organizations like the Islamic State had learned they could frustrate U.S. intelligence surveillance with encryption applications for sale online. As someone who values privacy, I understood and appreciated making encryption accessible to the private citizens of the world. At the same time, as President Obama said in January, "If we get into a situation in which the technologies do not allow us at all to track somebody that we're confident is a terrorist, if we find evidence of a terrorist plot somewhere in the Middle East that traces directly back to London or New York, we have specific information, and we are confident that this individual or this network is about to activate a plot, and despite knowing that information, despite having a phone number, or despite having a social media address or email address, that we can't penetrate that. That's a problem." It was clear to me that applications of digital technologies had fundamentally changed since 2010, when as USDI, I'd helped establish U.S. Cyber Command and dual-hatted the NSA director as Cybercom commander. Because commercial encryption had made cyber espionage exponentially more difficult, and the increased capabilities of our adversaries had made both offensive and defensive cyber operations more challenging, I decided to begin pushing to elevate Cybercom's status to equal that of U.S. Pacific Command or U.S. Strategic Command, and to separate it from NSA, preferably before January 20th, 2017. Fortunately, in the middle of dealing with Washington and Pentagon politics, I had an opportunity to travel, meet with deployed military and intelligence officers, and see the results of intelligence work. At the end of June, I went on a whirlwind tour of the Middle East with a final stop in Israel, our closest ally in the region, where I was scheduled for a rare personal meeting with the head of state. At the time, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was conducting a very public campaign against the impending Iran nuclear deal, even addressing a joint session of the U.S. Congress. Since I was in Israel as a representative of the president, who of course was in favor of the deal,